So we're going to start out with a really serious subject and do a political analysis of ERA. Everybody's thinking or worldview emanates from a leap of faith. You either trust reason or you trust revelation to tell you about reality. And I base my life on the revelation that we find in the Word of God. And therefore, much of what I say today will be contrary to modern thought, and it will be contrary to the input that we get from the media. And it's the media that has so shaped modern thought today. God said, "Let us make man in our image according to our likeness." And God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him. Male and female created he them. And the Lord God fashioned into a woman the rib which he had taken from the man and brought her to the man. And the man said, "This is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman because she was taken out of man." And the Lord God saw all that he had made, and behold, it was very good. Today we are being told that there is no difference between the male and the female except for anatomical differences. And Jean Hendricks says that the feminist movement has marched into our homes and propelled women into such male sanctuaries as police patrol cars, executive boardrooms, and the astronaut program. And we are told that we must not dress little girls in pink or little boys in blue, and we must not buy our children sexist toys. And if ever we are turned down because of our brand of hormones, it's a federal offense for a job. If we're turned down for a job because of our hormones, it's a federal offense. Well, all of this has created a monstrous complex of confusion as women try to decide what is really right. Can all of you hear me, like back in the back? Can you hear me? Okay, good. I'd like for us to look at the ERA, at the first part of the proposed 27th Amendment. A lot of people don't know what it really says. Let's just look at this first part right now. Equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. An issue of the Yale Law Journal, which was written by Professor Thomas I. Emerson and was handed out to every member of the House during the debate on the ERA, declared the ERA to be a doctrinaire of total equality, and it would allow for no discrimination and no distinction between the sexes. No preferential treatment on the behalf of the woman would ever be allowed under the ERA. And this would come into our personal lives because it would involve the military, education, employment, marriage, and divorce. So it would come into our personal lives. Now, when the ERA was taken to the Senate, there were many additions that were suggested to the ERA, and these additions were all rejected. And some of these additions included that the rights of women be retained, that women not be drafted, that the privacy of people be protected, that the husband be required by law to continue as prime supporter, that protective labor laws not be deleted, and that homosexual activity continue to be prohibited. Well, all of these additions were rejected. And proponents of the ERA said that such additions would cripple the amendment. Now, how could these additions cripple the amendment unless they were the basic intent of the amendment? Now, Betty Friedan, who's often called the mother of the modern women's liberation movement, says that the goal of feminism is to completely restructure existing institutions. And Mildred Persinger at the Colorado International Women's Year Conference said, "This is the first federally funded revolution." And I would like for us to look at some of the revolutionary goals that permeate the feminist literature. First of all, we'll look at their feelings concerning the home and the family, and then their feelings about sexuality, and third, at their legislative goal. Gloria Steinem, who is the editor of the Ms. Magazine, and the Ms. Magazine is considered the handbook of feminism, says, "It is necessary that we abolish and reform the institution of legal marriage." abolish and reform. And there can't be much doubt about what that means. The document, which is a declaration of feminism, says, marriage has existed for the benefit of man. The end of the institution of marriage is necessary for the liberation of woman. We must work to destroy it. Kate Millett calls for the abolition of the family structure and says that it might be replaced by voluntary association if such is desired. Well, you may think, this is really radical. I mean, this could never happen in our country. Well, the fact is that it is happening. And now we have more than 30,000 wives who run away from their homes annually. And this increase began in 1968 when the women's liberation movement first became vocal. And, of course, the people that suffer the most from runaway wives and runaway mothers is the children. And we've seen a great increase in the last 15 years in child suicides and in children's crimes, such as forcible rape. Well, what do the feminists say should be done about the problem of the children? They say that children must be seen as the responsibility of the entire society. And Professor Mary Jo Bain says we don't really know how to raise children equally. We must take them away from the family and raise them communally. The feminists are behind the push for federally funded daycare centers. And this would cost billions of dollars annually if we had federally funded daycare centers. And also, our children would be taught in those centers what the government wants to teach them. And this would be humanist values. The American Federation of Teachers is working tirelessly to change the compulsory schooling age of children to age 3, and hopefully age 2. What would happen to our children if we couldn't have them in those early years? So we can say that liberation to the feminist is the destruction of the institution of marriage and the home. And I could give you a lot more quotes, but I don't have time. But this is the gist. It's what permeates their literature. And if you go and buy Ms. Magazine, which is not a very encouraging magazine to read or to buy, but if you buy one, you'll see that this is true. Now let's look at their feelings about sexuality. The document says that liberation is the freedom to choose sex without restraint. In other words, to choose heterosexuality, homosexuality, lesbianism, or a combination, or whatever, without restraint. Betty Friedan says intolerant attitudes, often cultivated by religion, unduly repress sexuality. And two full pages of a document, which is just a very small pamphlet, two full pages are a call for full civil rights for lesbians. Now, this would mean that homosexuals would be teaching our children in the schools. And what would happen if professed homosexuals were teaching our children? Well, our children usually hold up their teachers as role models. And so homosexuality would become more respectable, and we would have more adherence to homosexuality. The feminists say that our children are being deprived of the full human talent. But homosexuality is an abomination to the Lord. The National Organization for Women recommends that sex counseling and contraception be given to teenagers in the schools without parental permission and without any reference to ideal or normal. And they also have some radical sex education programs that I can't tell you about in detail, but they use such books as Our Bodies, Ourselves, and there's some things in there that I couldn't even tell you. They're so bad. And they take perversions of sexuality and describe them in detail, and they don't give any reference to ideal or normal. And they'll do this in all ages in the school. So you really need to check out what your children are learning in this area in the schools. So liberation to the feminist is the freedom to choose sex without moral restraint. Okay, their legislative goal is the passage of the ERA. And I'd like for us to look at the whole thing. The second part says that the Congress shall have the power to enforce by appropriate legislation the provisions of this article. And then the third part. This amendment shall take effect 2 years after the date of ratification. Now, let's look at the first part again. Equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the U.S. or by any state on account of sex. The thing I would like to emphasize is that the Equal Rights Amendment is not needed for equal pay for equal work. Now, most people think that's all it is. But we already have all kinds of laws on the federal, the state, and the city level that guarantee equal pay for equal work to the woman. And the need is not for another law, but it is for the enforcement of the laws that we have. And some of the laws that we already have include the Equal Opportunity Act, the Equal Credit Act, and the Equal Pay Act. So this is unnecessary. It is also very uncertain. And if you notice, it's termed very generally. And any time you have an amendment to the Constitution, it is dangerous for it to be general. It needs to be specific. We're not certain what it will do. We do know that it is the Supreme Court that will decide how far it will come into our lives. And if we want to try to determine what it will do, what we need to do is to look to constitutional authorities. And we need to look to men who have spent their lives interpreting the Constitution. And I have depended on some men like this, and some of these are Professor Paul Friend, Harvard Law School, Professor James J. White, Michigan Law School, Professor Phil Kurland, Chicago Law School, Professor Thomas I. Emerson, Yale Law School, and Senator Sam Ervin, who's one of the nation's outstanding constitutional lawyers. And all of these men, although some are for ERA and some are against, all of them vary but little in their analysis of its effects. And they say that it is a positive thing that the ERA will do these things. It will cause women to be drafted and to definitely be in combat duty. It will legalize homosexual marriages and adoption by such marriages. And the reason for that is if two women go to get a marriage license and they're refused, they will be refused on the basis of sex. And there can be no distinction and no discrimination on the basis of sex under the ERA. So homosexual marriages will be legalized. Abortion on demand will be locked in. And churches who discriminate by not having a woman for a pastor or a homosexual for a pastor will lose their tax-exempt status. The requirement by law of a married man to support his family will be changed to read, a spouse must support the other spouse and the family. So we won't have that legal protection. Protected labor laws for women will be deleted. And some people have worked long and hard to get these protective labor laws for women. Now, the second part of the ERA is also very dangerous because this would mean that the federal government only would be able to legislate in these areas. All that power would be taken away from the states. And so we would have the federal government coming more and more into our lives. So in summary, liberation to the feminist is the destruction of the institution of marriage in the home, the freedom to choose sex without moral restraint, and the passage of the ERA, which is unnecessary, uncertain, and undesirable. Behind all of this is the philosophy of humanism. And I think that humanism is summed up in a really good way by an experience that a friend of mine had. I don't know if she's here today. But she had a little boy that's in the second grade. And one day his teacher asked the class, who is the most important person in the universe? Well, John raised his hand and he said, oh, God's the most important person in the universe. And the teacher said, well, no, that's not the answer I'm looking for. And so they talked about it a while. And finally, the answer came out that you are the most important person in the universe. And that is humanism. Man is at the center of everything, not God. And humanism rejects the supernatural. The Humanist Manifesto says that feminism is the path to humanism, and humanism is the goal. Gloria Steinem said, by the year 2000, we will, I hope, teach our children to believe in human potential and not in God. Another thing that has happened is that socialists have begun to convince many feminists that if socialism could take over the country, that they would be assured of equality and no discrimination. And two spokespersons are worthy of note. The first one is Vladimir Lenin. He said, "Notwithstanding all the liberating laws that have been passed, woman continues to be a domestic slave because petty housework crushes, strangles, stultifies, and degrades her, chains her to the kitchen and to the nursery, wastes her labor on barbarously unproductive, petty, nerve-wracking, stultifying, and crushing drudgery. The real emancipation of women, real communism, will begin only when a mass struggle is started against this petty domestic economy, or rather when it is transformed on a mass scale into a large-scale socialist economy." Okay, the second spokesperson is Chairman Mao Zedong, and he said, "In order to build a great socialist society, it is of the utmost importance to arouse the broad masses of women to join in productive activity. Men and women must receive equal pay for equal work in production. Genuine equality between the sexes can only be realized in the process of the socialist transformation of society as a whole." Now, what has happened in these socialist countries? The men have wages that are so low that the woman has to go to work. And usually she works in the factory, in the fields, or in the mines. And then she comes home to her traditional chores. And these chores are compounded by shortage lines that are everywhere. And so instead of the woman being liberated, her responsibilities have been increased to the breaking point. Now, what does God say about all this? Let's turn to Romans 1, verses 21 through 25. And I'd just like for you to read along with me in this. You got it? Okay, it's page 1082. "For even though they knew God," verse 21, "even though they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks, but they became futile in their speculations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the incorruptible God for an image in the form of corruptible man and of birds and four-footed animals and crawling creatures. Therefore, God gave them over in the lust of their hearts to impurity, that their bodies might be dishonored among them. For they exchanged the truth of God for a lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen." We fear that socialism, humanism, lesbianism, and feminism are being brought together in a new unity, abolishing step by step the remnants of Judeo-Christian principles upon which our nation was built.
The next section that we're going to deal with this morning, and so that we've dealt with the world before our break, and then we'll go more and more into the scriptures, is the cultural aspect. Ruth Ann dealt with the political, and now we're going to deal with the cultural. I'd like for you to look at your quote page, look under the second section, and read with me this quote. You can read silently while I read it aloud. "The woman's issue will be the issue of the 80s. It is an issue of no little importance. It carries with it a kind of momentum that may well be irreversible in future history. We're not talking primarily about simple economic equality. We are talking about a spirit of the age. The church cannot escape it. It pervades the media with such an intensity that it becomes increasingly difficult to approach the whole issue with any sort of clear head." Now, I just want to give you an overview today of how much it pervades the media by relating to you what I found on the newsstands this month was the tail end of my research. I went over to a big magazine rack where all the magazines were laid out there at Safeway, and I went through cover after cover after cover. I went through these magazines thoroughly and took notes. This is what I found in the media in 1 month, for this month, the month of December. U.S. News and World Report, their feature article was Battle of the Sexes, Men Fight Back. The men have had it. In fact, there is a men's liberation organization starting back east right now. If you read that article, you'll find out about it. Now, do you know what the key issues are that they're discussing in this liberation? I was sharing this with my high school students, and one of the cute boys in the class raised his hand and he said, I know what the issue is. He said, I want my rib back. The key issues that they're dealing with are issues that result out of divorce, like child custody, that the mother would have the children for half the time, the children would pack their bags on Wednesday and go to the father's house for the remainder of the week, equal pay, all that kind of thing, which would tear the child apart. The issue, they said, is not whether the mother should have the children or the father should have the children, but the child needs mothering. Now, whether that happens by the father or the mother is the question. Okay, the second magazine I looked at was Working Woman. The New Courage, this was an article in Working Woman, The New Courage, Challenging Macho Mystique. Third magazine was Ms. Magazine, and of course that's on the racks every month. Next magazine was Savvy Magazine, and it was subtitled The Magazine for Executive Women. Another magazine was Self. It's called Self. One of the key articles in there was Future Power, Women as the Majority. There was an article, I skimmed through those articles in that magazine. There was one in there that dealt with a woman executor initiating sex with a junior partner. Say she was the president of the company, the junior partner was a male, and he was the vice president, that all of the cultural norms and mores, even in the secular field of the man initiating sex or, you know, taking his secretary out for an affair or whatever, would be totally reversed, that where the woman could initiate in that way with her junior vice president male partner. And just so the taboos were completely off, even in the world's sphere. Also in that article, there was an article entitled Count Your Winnings. It says that real estate is being taken over by females. It is up 37% in the last 10 years, which means, of course, that you have women buying real estate either because they're single or because they're divorced or because at the initial part of their marriage they want to make sure to get all of the financial things on equal territory so that if there should be a split, they'd be well protected. Another article in there, that magazine, was now more women are in college and graduate school than men who are over 35 years of age. And, of course, what that reveals is that women are, by the droves, going back to school. Now, what are they going into? Well, the article revealed that they are peopling the fields of medicine and law, that those two and the business field is up as well. They said that by 1990 it will be up 8 times over the 60s, the number of women that are in the fields of business. The traditional fields of women in nursing or in education being the big one, show that the women entering and going for education degrees are now down by half this decade to what they were before. So women are going for the big bucks. They're going for the places of influence. Brides Magazine, another magazine, the feature article. Now, Brides Magazine is for people just starting out with their marriages. It's before the honeymoon has begun. It's supposed to be a pie-in-the-sky, you know, romantic kind of look at the thing. Well, the feature article was Career Jealousy, the New Marriage Problem of the 80s. As I perused that article, it said the conclusions it came to was keep your own careers moving, and number two, accept that one of you will have to sacrifice. Doesn't say which one. Cosmopolitan Magazine ran an article about the lawyers in Washington, the influx of women lawyers in Washington. The article began with These low-key ladies in high-powered places represent a budding breed of attorney, legal eagles, who are feisty, frisky, fat cat, foxy, and female. Now, I will relate to you some of the lifestyles of these women lawyers a bit later in my talk. It's amazing. And then an additional magazine was Time Magazine. It carried a story about religion, Must God Be He? The Sexual Textual Revolution Hits the Bible. And this article, it's entitled Unmanning the Holy Bible. It deals with changing all of the sexual terms in the Bible to either neuter or masculine. Now, neuter or feminine. This is no joke. This is not theory. The whole idea right now is up before the Council of the United Churches. What is it, NCC? United Council of Churches, right. And they are taking the RSV version of the Bible. That's the one they want to hit and transfer all those sexual innuendos. So it is before the board right now, and they're very seriously considering it. What page is it? It's in this month's time. It's last week's, I guess. December 9th, 8th issue. If you want to look at it afterwards, you're welcome to. So I want to say again that we're not involved in mere idle talk. We are riding a roller coaster of trend, a tidal wave of implications. And as I mentioned before, when Ruth Ann and I began studying this, we had no idea how complex it was, how far-reaching it was. Now, the emancipation for women has a direct correlation with the wreckage of the home. And we saw that in Ruth Ann's talk about what has happened with child suicides, etc. The liberationists don't equate this freedom for women with the wreckage of the home. And if they do equate it, see, the statistics run just right neck and neck. If they do equate it, they don't want to emotionally, because the prizes of self-fulfillment are so high, they want it at any cost. In other words, they're blind to the data, emotionally blind. Chuck Colson spoke out here at Glen Eyrie last spring, and some of you may have been here to hear that talk. He said if you could take the modern statistics, the recent statistics about what has happened to the modern family, and plug those in to a computer in terms of trends, he said, we will run out of families before we run out of gasoline. So we're not on the cutting edge of the thing. We are dead smack in the center of it, in the center of the battle. I saw a program on television a little over a year ago that related there are now 13 different family styles you can have in America. So that the traditional home of mother and father and children is really waxing thin. We're seeing less and less of that. You can have a mother who has children marry a divorced man. You can have the divorced man who has children marry a woman who doesn't have children. You can have both of those who have combined families, and that's very interesting in terms of all the implications. You can have a child being raised only by the father. You can have a child being raised only by the mother. You can have a homosexual marriage, etc. You can add them up. Now, so what is the core of our cultural tension? Sociologists say that the family unit is the core of culture. And when the family unit goes, even non-Christians say this, when the family unit goes, you have a good indication of where your total culture is. Now, what is at the hub of the family unit but the relationship between man and woman? So the core of the problem is the way that men and women interact. It is the pivotal point of our culture. And when we get insight into that interaction, it gives us insight into the larger culture as well. Now, we are told in Scripture that men are to be in leadership positions and that women are to be in support roles, not just in the church, but even in the culture at large. Now, that was a new idea to me. I had studied it pretty thoroughly within the context of the church. I had not thought about it in relation to the culture. I had thought about it, but I had questions. Now, I want to share with you those findings this morning. Before I do that, I want to share with you one more thing from the world. God has so structured man's innate ability as to ensure that he will be in a leadership capacity. Now, that comes out very clearly in a secular book that was written called The Inevitability of Patriarchy. And I want to share with you what that book came up with, what that man's research came up with. If you want to get this book, it's called The Inevitability of Patriarchy, which means it's inevitable that men lead. Okay, not a matriarchy, but a patriarchy. And it's written by Stephen Goldsberg, G-O-L-S-B-E-R-G. Now, he says that that men are to be in leadership positions. Men just innately are to be in leadership positions. I don't think he would argue that on a biblical basis. But he argues this from two points. One is from anthropology, and the other is from biology. Now, what he found, what he discovered in the research in anthropology, is that there has never been a society, even a tribe, where a woman has been in leadership, where it's been a matriarchy, and it has sustained itself. In other words, every time a tribe moves towards matriarchy, the thing falls apart. The culture falls apart. And he went into New Guinea in Africa. He said in New Guinea he came to finding one. He said there both of the roles, the masculine and feminine role, were worked out in a very passive way. Both of them were extremely passive, and then soon it fell. So he said it is an extremely unstable condition in culture when you have women leading. In fact, in all of history, he has not found a matriarchy that has sustained itself. That's the argument from anthropology. The argument from biology is very interesting. I loved this research. He said that a man's hormone, the hormone of androgen, makes the man extremely aggressive. Now, this is shown out in statistics like men do more violent crimes than women. Just statistics bear that out. But it is essential that man has this hormone for leadership positions. Now, he went into a study of the intellectual paralysis of both men and women. And he found on this spectrum, there you have geniuses up here and you have all kinds of intellectual abilities here, and then you have morons or the uneducable down here. He said that in the genius category, in the upper end of the genius category, you do not find women in that area. Never in history. Now that's a startling fact. Let me reinforce it by some data. And one of the reasons why you find men over here and not women is because geniuses, many of the geniuses in history, have had to work through phenomenal hardships and obstacles to surface with their thing. And it is this hormone of androgen that helps them do that. For example, you have Beethoven writing music when he's deaf, Michelangelo lying on his back for hours and hours and hours. And a woman may not have been able to take that. Now, he said that one area where you find women do exceptionally well. Now, we're not talking about no brilliant women. There are many brilliant women. We're talking about the upper echelons of genius. He said that the area where women come closest is in the area of literature, because we're talkers. women are facile with verbiage. They're creative with verbiage. You listen to the way a woman prays and the way a man prays. They're very, very facile, very flexible. But even in that field, you name me one woman Shakespeare or Dante. You see, they're in a league all to themselves. All right, now another one. Name me one musician, one composer that's a woman. Bach, Handel, Tchaikovsky, Brahms. Do you know why? Because he maintains men have ability to think in abstract areas that women don't. Now, women can think abstractly, but when it gets into this league over here, they drop out. For example, you don't find any women chess players surfacing above men. And in Russia, they have had equal opportunity. Women have been playing chess for years. And you can't... The one area where people will argue, they'll say, what about Marie Curie? Well, she was a practical scientist. You see, measurable data, practical implications, inferences, all that she could handle. But when you're talking about breaking through like Einstein, theories of relativity, thinking in the abstract, you can't name one woman. And you can't argue that, well, it's because women have been suppressed and that's why we don't see that thing surface. Well, the men, like I just said, the obstacles they've overcome, if there had been genius, it would have surfaced. Because it would overcome those obstacles. Like I said, in Russia, they have been given more of an equal chance, and still we don't find one chess player. So we know that geniuses need an incredible driving power. In fact, many geniuses say that there is a spirit within them that almost drives them. And many of them say they hate it. It's a thing that just takes over. Okay, Margaret Mead, she is a woman that would be more on the feminist side. She said that she analyzed this book and she said that Goldsberg handles the data flawlessly. She critiqued his book and said he handles the data flawlessly. Okay, now let's go. So the inevitability of patriarchy is even upheld by the world in their own studies. Now let's go to the scriptures, see what the Lord says. Would you turn to Isaiah chapter 3? Verses 8 through 14. Yes. Isaiah chapter 3, verse 8 through 14. Okay, now the setting of this passage is that Judah is going to fall. Jerusalem has stumbled and Judah is going to fall. Okay, read with me. For Jerusalem has stumbled and Judah has fallen, because their speech and their actions are against the Lord, to rebel against his glorious presence. The expression of their faces bears witness against them, and they display their sin like Sodom. This is not a high point in culture. They display their sin like Sodom. They do not even conceal it. Woe to them, for they have brought evil on themselves. Say to the righteous that it will go well with them, for they will eat the fruit of their actions. But woe to the wicked. It will go badly with him, for what he deserves will be done to him. Now here's the catch verse. O my people, their oppressors are children, and women rule over them. Underline it, star it. O my people, listen to the next verse. Those who guide you lead you astray and confuse the direction of your paths. The Lord arises to contend and stands to judge the people. Now listen to this. The Lord enters into judgment with whom? The Lord enters into judgment with the elders and princes of his people. That's masculine. So somebody reneged on, somebody didn't hold up their end of the task, and the Lord enters into judgment with them first. Because the men have not been strong leaders, have not moved into spiritual leadership. The women have taken over, and God will enter into judgment with the men first, and the culture will bear the brunt of it. Now, in this article from Cosmopolitan, it talks about that they are really moving towards the next Supreme Court justice being a woman. That, and then of course you know of Mayor Jane Byrne in San Francisco. Jane Byrne was of Chicago. Here's one of San Francisco. If you want to come up and look at her after a while and look at the consternation in her face as she leads, what the pressures have done to her. Okay, now I want to share with you something else. In that same chapter, verses 16 through 26, you have that big rundown of frivolous women. Moreover, the Lord said, because the daughters of Zion are proud and walk with heads held high and seductive eyes and go along with mincing steps and tinkle the bangles of their feet. You know, you're familiar with all that. The headbands and the bracelets and the you know, feet chains and all that. There is a direct correlation between frivolous womanhood and the degradation of a culture. When women are looking in the mirror more than they're looking in the face of God, we've got a culture that's falling. And when women are more at the citadel than they are listening to their children and the relational things that are going on in their homes, we're on dangerous ground. So the connection there is really significant. And it would really, you have to go and sit in front of these scriptures and meditate and read them over and over sometimes I'd be reading them and it would just reverberate. And I'd think, Lord, this is so contrary to what I've thought, you know. And you just have to bathe yourself in the scriptures. Okay, the next thing I want to share with you is Nahum chapter 3. If you're ever sharing this with someone, remember it's Isaiah chapter 3 and Nahum chapter 3. Nahum is in the Minor Prophets, as you know, and it's between Micah. It's between Micah and Habakkuk. Nahum chapter 3. Verse 10, let's start. Now the background of this passage is that Nineveh is coming to a complete ruin. Utter devastation, it will be wiped out. And Nineveh, you know, was the capital of Assyria. Okay, verse 10, it says, "Yet she became an exile. She went into captivity. Also her small children were dashed to pieces at the head of every street." Now, listen to this next verse. "They cast lots for her honorable men, and all her great men were bound with fetters." Where are the men? They're bound. They're inactive. They're not in the picture. All right, now verse 11. "You too will become drunk. You will be hidden. You too will search for a refuge from the enemy." Verse 12. "All your fortifications are fig trees with ripe fruit. When shaken, they fall into the eater's mouth." In other words, the big thick walls around your city are just like trees. They're going to fall and somebody's going to eat them up. Then, "Behold, your people are women in your midst." Now, this is not some great day for women's lib. This is not a picture of strength and power and glorious leadership. Your people are women in your midst. That means they're not, the people are without leadership, without guidance, without direction. Then look at the next part. "The gates of your land are open." When your people become like women in your midst, "the gates of your land are opened wide to your enemies. Fire consumes your gate bars." Interesting, isn't it? Okay, the next section of scripture I want to share with you is in Jeremiah chapter 44. Like if we look with me at verse 19. Now, G. Campbell Morgan does a study of these passages, and his insights, I felt, were just profound. Look at verse 19. It says, "And said the women..." Now, wait. First of all, where is this set in the book of Jeremiah? It's set at the end. This is the end of their devastation. It's at the end, right before they're ready to fall. That's where it's put. Okay, verse 19. "And said the woman, when we were burning sacrifices to the..." Who of heaven? The queen of heaven. Well, since when has God been the queen? They have done what? They have tampered with the gender of the Godhead. And what did we see here? In Time magazine. So it says, "When we were burning sacrifices to the queen of heaven and were pouring out libations to her, was it without our husbands?" Who has full knowledge that this is going on? The men. They not only have full knowledge, but they're endorsing it, encouraging it. What do we find with the ERA movement? "That we made for her sacrificial cakes in her image and poured out libations to her." Then verse 22, the Lord says, "So the Lord was no longer able to endure it because of the evil of your deeds." This is not an exciting moment for women. In verse 24, it says, "Then Jeremiah said to all the people, including all the women," the scriptures, the Lord wants us to know that this message is to the women. Usually it's just to the people or to the men, but he put that in parentheses, to the women. Then verse 25 says, "Thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, as follows, as for you and your wives, you have spoken with your mouths and fulfilled it with your hands, saying, we will certainly perform our vows, that we have vowed to burn sacrifices to the Queen of Heaven and pour out libations to her. Go ahead and confirm your vows, and certainly perform your vows. Nevertheless, hear the word of the Lord. All Judah who are living in the land of Egypt, behold, I have sworn by my great name, says the Lord, never shall my name be invoked again by the mouth of any man of Judah in all the land of Egypt. Then verse 27, behold, I'm watching over them for harm and not for good. So that's the Lord's statement about that state of affairs. Now I want to share with you what Morgan says. Oh, first of all, let me just go back to Jeremiah chapter 38, verse 20. I want to show you one more thing and then we'll analyze this. Jeremiah 38, verse 20. Now, Jeremiah is speaking to the men of the culture here. He says, but Jeremiah said, they will not go over you. Please obey the Lord in what I'm saying to you, that it may go well with you and you may live. He's pleading with the men. Now, verse 21 says, but if you keep refusing to lead, if you keep refusing to go out, this is the word which the Lord has shown me. Then behold, all of the women who have been left in the palace of the king of Judah are going to be brought out to the officers of the king of Babylon, and those women will say, your close friends have misled and overpowered you. While your feet were sunk in the mire, they turned back. They also will bring out your wives and your sons, blah, blah, blah. What this is saying is that the women will come out and taunt you for your lack of leadership. The women will come out and degrade you for your lack of leadership. Okay, the ultimate in rebellion, this is what Morgan says, the ultimate in rebellion is putting the feminine in the heavens. Instead of just a pagan god, it's a god with a female gender. The women reproached the men for their maladministration that brought on the ruin of Judah. That's what you saw in chapter 38. The women reproached the men for their maladministration. Now Morgan says, the hand that rocks the cradle rules the world. He quotes that from, you've all heard that. He says, the influence of motherhood upon manhood is something from which manhood never wholly escapes. It has a profound impact. You know, if you watch the football games, these big husky players, you know, when they come on, they interview them at the end, who do they say hello to? Mama. You think about that. Morgan says, if these finer things, these more wonderful things, these more delicate things of womanhood are once bent and degraded, they become a blight, a mildew, and a blasting more terrible than the clash of arms or sweeping of plague. If the women are openly defying Jehovah, then there is no hope. And that's what they're doing. Then he says, when women have sweetened, subdued, and ennobled all the life of manhood, men will be compelled to finer attitudes, nobler ambitions, and more glorious issues. John Ruskin said that when true womanhood throughout the world shall say that war must cease, war will cease. We have a power that's incredible. It's not here. It's there. You know, man, they've done studies on men who are single and stuff, and there's something about the hub of a home that makes them productive. It puts them at rest and lets them channel their energies in another place, in civilization and building up of culture. Now, Morgan also says, it is that strong quality, strong with a delicate weaving of infinite tendernesses and gentlenesses and beauty, which is the supreme glory of womanhood. May God deliver us from a day when anything rough and tumble shall spoil the finer delicacies of womanhood. It is in all these things that she is to represent God. She represents the feminine side of God. And Eliot's going to go into that more. There is given to woman a separate and sacred responsibility, that into which no man can ever fully enter, for the unveiling of profound truth concerning God. What a delight! What a privilege is ours. Not only is it true that God is Father, it is also true that God is Mother. In womanhood, it is intended that there shall be an unveiling of these mystic and mysterious depths of tenderness, which are the very essence of eternal strength, which can best be understood by such mortals as we are, by the holy and sacred mystery and wonder and power of motherhood. See, we need to regain the glory of that, who we are. And this last one, the manhood of a nation is perpetually under the dominion of its womanhood. And yet the womanhood of the nation is influenced by what the manhood of that nation is. You see, in the beginning of Jeremiah, men left God. That's why the women came out and reproached them. The men left first. So all the woman does, well, I'll read it. The peculiar power which womanhood exercises over the life of manhood in a national life is that of confirming, intensifying, solidifying the facts they find already. If the men are strong, the women are going to confirm that, solidify it, intensify it. In the beginning of Jeremiah, we saw that men turned to idolatries and that women were baking cakes for them. Later, they say that their whole reason for their determined hostility to Jehovah is that the women burn incense to the Queen of Heaven. The men blame the women. So you have a direct twist. Now the last scripture I want to take you into is Deborah. Deborah is the one that the women's livers run under for spiritual clout. She's our leader. And the feminists, you see, there's a whole pocket of people that are biblical feminists. They just put the name God over it. It's the same thinking. They just, oh, and I'll tell you, the logic leaps. We read through some of Scanzoni's stuff, and just logically, the stuff is extremely anemic. Okay, Deborah. Look in Judges. Chapter 4. I asked the Lord before studying Deborah. I just got down on my knees. In fact, there have been many times, and both Ruth Ann and I have done this, just almost weeping. Lord, show us the truth. Don't let us bring our culture to this. Don't let us bring our own presuppositions. Show us the truth. Well, this was one of those nights I almost wept. You know, I just got down on my knees before a chair, and I said, Lord, this is the pivotal point. This woman is the cause of a lot of, it doesn't fit with the rest of what I think you're saying. Show me the truth about it. And I'll tell you, the thing came sizzling. I got more excited. As the night waxed thin, I got more and more excited. I couldn't believe what this is really saying. And I want to share with you, I really think it's from the Lord. You'll have to test it in your own hearts. First of all, I went back to the first of Judges. What's the setting into which Deborah comes? The setting is that Judges, the book of Judges reveals that the people are in apostasy, they are in terrible sin, and they are in cycles of sin. They get very, very sinful, and then the Lord sends them a judge. The judge delivers them, and it says, and the land was at rest for 12 years. And then they go into another cycle, terrible sin. The Lord sends them a judge, and the land was at rest for 40 years. And then it says, this phrase is repeated over and over, they did evil continually in the sight of the Lord. They did evil again. They did evil again. Now, the Lord didn't send any mouse of men to be the judges. He sent strong men. In fact, at the end of chapter 3, the last verse says, and after him came Shamgar, the son of Anath, who struck down 600 Philistines with an ox goad, and he also saved Israel. All right, here you got one man. Come on, bring him on. And he just machetes down 600 men single-handedly. Now, these aren't exactly mice of men. But what happens is that there's only one of them. The whole culture is out of it. And so the Lord is so frustrated with his people that he says, all right, I have sent you man after man after man after man, and you continue to sin. Now I will send you a woman. And this woman will be a picture of how weak you are. This woman is a judgment on the land. And I think that Deborah had a profound understanding of that. I don't think she thought, yay, team, I have made it to the top of the hill. And isn't this wonderful, Israel's following me. I think she had an awesome respect for what God was doing through her. Now, it says in verse 1, "Then the sons of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord." There's your phrase that has happened over and over. Now, if you go down to verse 4, it says, "Now Deborah, prophetess, the wife of Lahad, was judging Israel at that time." Now, turn over to verse 8. Now, here's the man that the culture surfaces, Barak. The only man they can come up with. Okay, then Barak said to her, "If you will go with me, then I will go. But if you will not go with me, I will not go." We have the picture of strength here. The picture of courage. The picture of masculinity. Look at his dependence upon Deborah. "If you'll go with me, I'll go. But if you won't go with me, I won't go." Verse 9. "And she said, I will surely go with you." They're talking about a battle. They're going to go into a battle. She said, "I will surely go with you." You can just see her going, "I will surely go with you." Disgusted. "Nevertheless, the honor shall not be yours on the journey that you're about to take, for the Lord will sell Sisera into the hands of a woman." Now, the tone of this passage, unless I'm overinterpreting, I don't think I am. The tone of this passage is, the honor should go to you, Barak, but because you are so weak, you need me to go with you. The ultimate prize of the battle, so to speak, is going to fall into the hands of a woman. Was her attitude, "Yay, team, women are going to lead this. I'm going to go down there into the battle, and even the head of the enemy will go into our hands." No, it was utter frustration with Barak. Now, look further down at verse 14. This is the day of the battle. "And Deborah said to Barak, Arise, for this is the day in which the Lord has given Sisera into your hands." Notice she's trying to endorse him as a man. Even though the head of the thing is going to fall into the hands of a woman, she's still trying to buoy him up and encourage him. "It's going to go into your hands, Barak. Behold, the Lord has gone out before you." Now I ask you, why was Barak still asleep? It was like she went over, here he is stretched out, and she kind of kicked him. And "Arise, Barak, for this is the day." You see, who had been up since sunbreak? Deborah. Imploring the Lord. She knew the Lord's mind so much, she said, this is the day he's going to deliver him. Now, where is the Moses in this man? You know, holding up his arms and the battle will win as long as the arms are up. The battle will go well. Where's the David in him? I'll take on a giant. I don't care who it is, with the power of the Lord, I'll take him on and I'll win. Where is the Moses and the David in Barak? Not there. Now, if you go back up to verse 9 again, notice she doesn't say, okay, I will lead the armies down into the valley. She says, I will go with you. Again, she's maintaining a tremendously godly position, a feminine position. I will go with you. I will support you. I will aid you. And notice also that she says, I'll go with you, only after he has initiated. He said, will you go with me? And then she says, I will go with you. So she's godly in her responsiveness to his initiation, even in this terribly difficult situation. All right, then the story gets more exciting. Would you go to verse 16? The last part of that verse, it says, all the army fell, and there was not even one left. In other words, Barak got the message. He got the appetite. He was licking his chops. Man, everyone, I've been able to kill everyone. It says not one was left except the leader, Sisera. Now, do you know why I think there was one left, the leader? I think the Lord let him kill everybody so that he knew that he could have had the power to kill even the leader. I think the Lord let him take that much to show him, Barak, you could have had the whole nine yards. But you, because you didn't go out in my power, you weren't looking for me, etc., I denied you the leader, the chief elk. The one you really want, I'm going to take it. It's going to slip out of your hands. Now, verse 21. So this guy, the leader, wanders all over. And then Jael, Heber's wife, took a tent peg and seized a hammer in her hands. Oh, you have to go up a couple verses, verse 19. He said, this is the leader now. He's escaped and he's off in this area. He says, please give me a little water to drink, for I'm thirsty. So she opened a bottle of milk and gave him a drink. And then she covered it. Then verse 20. Then he said to her, "Stand in the doorway of the tent, and it shall be if anyone comes and inquires of you and says, 'Is there anyone here?' that you shall say no." But Jael, Heber's wife, took a tent peg and seized a hammer in her hand and went secretly to him and drove the peg into his temple. And it went through into the ground, for he was sound asleep and exhausted, so he died. How did the guy die? Face to face in battle, man to man. He died by the cunning and craft of a woman. Now, verse 22, this is cute. "And behold, Barak pursued Sisera." There he is out there, you know, with this. He's still ready to go. Where is he? Where is he? I've got the taste of battle now. And his chief enemy is taken right out of his hands. Now, remember when Deborah said the honor will go to a woman? The honor and the praise? Well, look over in Judges chapter 5, verse 24, and here's the honor. Here's the honor. All of Israel, they're singing. They're excited. They're rejoicing. There's music. Verse 24 says, "Most blessed of women." Now the tumult starts singing this. "In Jael, the wife of Heber, the Kenite. Most blessed is she of women in the tent. He asked for water and she gave him milk. In a magnificent bowl she brought him curds. She reached out her hand for the tent peg and her right hand for the workman's hammer. Then she struck Sisera. She smashed his head and she shattered and pierced his temple. Between her feet he bowed. He fell. He lay. Between her feet he bowed. He fell. Where he bowed, there he fell dead." Now here's Barak over at the side, hearing the multitude singing this, and it was eating his lunch. I mean, you know, when he heard that uproar of praise and exaltation go to this woman, that he was just, it was eating him up inside. Here was the honor given to a woman that should have been his. He took the rest of the battle. Okay, so the conclusions I draw from that are that Deborah knew what she was about. She knew why she was there, and she was not happy about the condition of the culture. It was not a good situation. Okay, so I want to say, pull you back to culture now. I think career is the battleground for leadership in the culture. That one of the dangers of career is that it is a battleground for leadership. So I think as women, we need to examine careers for that ingredient. Now, if you have a career that's teaching or helping your kids and it has the same hours that your kids do, or you have a career that you do part-time outside the home or whatever, we're not talking about that. We're talking about the leadership positions, the places of influence in the culture. And you would have to determine before God what those places would be. Second danger I want to say about career. See, there's a mass exodus from the home to career. It is a battleground for leadership in the culture. So you have to be very careful, prayerfully go into what it would be that the Lord would have you in. And the second thing is, career, I call it the myth of fulfillment. Career, the myth of fulfillment, and you can subtitle it, career stress. This mass exodus into career has fed us the lie that you should be a perfect mother and a perfect career woman. And who has the energy for that? I am single. I am perhaps one of the most fulfilled women in all of Colorado Springs. I love my job. Can't wait to get up in the morning. But I'll tell you, when I go home at night, I'm exhausted. And I can't imagine feeding children and being dear to a husband. Now, it can be done, and I think in the Lord's strength, He allows you to. I'm just saying that's a danger. All right, now, in this article about Washington's women lawyers, see this? I want to relate to you just a couple quotes and then we'll end, about what their lives are like. These are the biggies. "As for coping with the mentally draining profession of law and the added stress of seeing to a family," notice it's the added stress of seeing to a family. It's not the added stress of career, it's the added stress of seeing to a family. "Riddle says she makes do by merely skipping the amenities. For the present, she and her architect husband and their children eat cold dinners. She does laundry bi-weekly and cleans the house only on Sunday." That's her life. Another woman. After a decade of practice, the combination of law, husband, child resulted in divorce. When I was 22, I could go to law school, work, and still come home and cook dinner, she says. I had the energy then, but 10 years later, I didn't. I'd be working 18 hours a day. 18 hours a day. Where are her children? And when I'd get home, it was all I could do to feed myself, let alone everyone else. And my husband wanted me to attend business functions with him regularly, and I just couldn't do it. This one. Having a job as a full-time attorney requires a phenomenal support system at home. Who is supporting who? The mother of 4 children under the ages of 5. Gilbert engages a regular governess, a part-time cleaning woman, and daily round-the-clock teenage help. The teenage help is what I can't believe. One youngster comes in. Listen to this. One youngster comes in from 8 o'clock a.m. till 7 o'clock p.m. to care for the babies. This is a high schooler. Another's on duty from 2:30 till 6 p.m. and puts a meal on the table. A third teenager arrives at 10 o'clock p.m. and sleeps in the youngest baby's room to relieve mommy of the 3 o'clock a.m. feeding. And husband Bill, also an attorney, helps with everything, including the laundry. And then at the end of this article, this is the one that says, and there is no doubt in the mind of any of the female attorneys heard from that the next justice to be appointed to the Supreme Court will be a woman. Now, here's another one I got out of McCall's, April. The title is How I Survived My Promotion. Parenthetically, I might add, my duties to my family did not magically come to a screeching halt. Shortly after I started on my new job, my husband suffered a heart attack and had open-heart surgery. This isn't any little flu that he had. Although I lost very little time from work, isn't that marvelous? The care and feeding of the important man in my life was uppermost in my mind at all times. Fortunately, I had the help of one of my 3 children, my 18-year-old son, who was a student and still living at home. My son helped by putting dinner, which I had prepared the night before, in the oven, setting the table and doing the dishes. He also took away many household chores that I had previously handled. In addition, he was a sympathetic listener and provided a strong shoulder to cry on when I needed it. Now, why did she need to cry? Because the woman is stretched so thin. And who is the mother in the family? The 18-year-old son. Once my husband recovered from his operation and was back at work, he too was a great moral support to me. Whenever my job got to be too much, why did her job get to be too much? Or if I needed advice in a trying or unfamiliar situation. At the beginning of Ladies Home Journal, it says, it was talking about working women, and it listed several, and it ended with, Sue Huffman, our food and equipment editor, is divorced, has 2 children. You know, they say that like she's popping aspirin. Has 2 children, and thus faces the intense juggling of babysitters and emergency calls from school. These, plus the 30 or so other women working in the office from the early 20s on, give us the conviction that women are all on the way up. Their relationships are havoc. Their work world is going great. And that's where our priorities should be, right? The last one, Cheryl Ladd. I'll show you this picture. I think the title of this article is significant. It says, Juggling Sanity and Success. Can a successful TV star moonlight as a devoted wife and mother? Notice it isn't moonlighting with your job. It's moonlighting as a devoted wife and mother. Yes, says Cheryl Ladd. Much of the fight consists of keeping her career and her family in delicate balance and in top-notch shape. The fight almost requires 2 people, she said. Well, almost. There is the home person and the working me, the career me, she explains. At home, she dresses in shorts, knee socks, T-shirt, and her hair is tied loosely in the back. But rather, when she's about to go out to the set of Charlie's Angels, but later when she's about ready to go out to Charlie's Angels, you know, that's who she is. When she says goodbye to the 2 maids in white uniforms, heads to her black Mercedes. You see, when they're talking about women's libbers, they're talking about upper crust. What does it do to the middle class and lower class income family people who can't get a governess and 2 maids? The shorts and knee socks discarded for a sophisticated leather pantsuit and cap, she is unquestionably Cheryl the actress. I might be having a nice conversation with a girlfriend about diapers or children, something I'm really interested in, she continues, when the phone rings and bam, it's about who I have to call about the wardrobe thing. It's back to the professional me again. Sometimes it gets me crazy. Now, there was a woman, Ruth Ann gave me this. A mother's question. This came out of a Christian periodical. Look at her. Very polished, very refined. Was going up and up in the business world. Very adequate. Had 4 children, and she decided to quit. And this tells about it, and it's really revealing. And like over here, she said one day she was telling her son, her high school son, I'd given him some minor instruction, and he snapped back, I've already raised myself. Why are you trying to tell me to do that now? And she said that hit her. That is how he has interpreted all these years. She says the challenge of being a mother, providing encouragement and love, to compete with TV and amusements all over that the culture is giving is a full-time job. Anyway, she says, I know that as a Christian I'm admonished to become active in fighting the moral issues of our day. I must be different from the world, and a marvelous place to start is at my own address. I asked the kids at school if they would tell me what a mother is. This little kid said, it's a human helper sent by God to do what's right and best for us, to help us growing up, somebody that's always there. A mother is someone who cares when nobody else seems to. A mother is very desperate to go to bed. A mother is a friend you can tell all your thoughts to. That doesn't happen on the run. And the last one, this was a little sixth grader. A mother is a shelter from the storm of night, someone to hold you when you're in a fright, a person to love you with all their heart that won't fret if you're not smart, somebody to depend on in troubled times, who helped you in kindergarten drawing circles and lines, who laughs at the mess made by the dog, who taught you all about the only God. Eyes like pools, heart like a song. There's different opinions, but I love my mom. Made it up. On the spot. She's one of my gifted kids. The last thing I want to say is there is a beautiful testimony in culture, in history, about a woman who stayed home and did her homework with her kids. And it's the life of Jonathan Edwards and his wife, Sarah Edwards. The amazing thing is that in 1900, a study revealed that the single marriage of Sarah and Jonathan Edwards had produced 13 college presidents, 65 professors, 100 lawyers, and a dean of an outstanding law school, 30 judges, 66 physicians, and a dean of a medical school, 800 holders of public office, 3 U.S. senators, mayors of 3 large cities, governors of 3 states, a vice president of the United States, a controller of the U.S. Treasury. At a reunion of between 400 and 500 descendants of Jonathan and Sarah, the mood was expressed by Woodbridge, "Let God be praised."